Welcome back to Power Hour. Thank you for joining us, caring about your world. It's all about the truth. Well, we're going to be talking to James Corbett today, thecorbettreport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T, report.com. You know, one of the, I think, the highest callings or the highest compliments that one can give another person is that they are an independent thinker. So hard to be, so hard to do. And yet he is an independent thinker, writer, journalist, investigator on so many issues. And we're just very pleased to have him join us every other week here on the Power Hour. Thank you so much, James, for joining us on the Power Hour today.
Well, I'm blushing from ear to ear now. I'm not sure that's a good way to start the interview, but thank you so much, Joyce. I do appreciate it, and I always appreciate the chance to talk to you and your audience.
Well, you deserve it. Certainly, you deserve it. We're looking at so much right now that a lot of people do know about, a lot of the people that listen to the Power Hour know about, but the rest of the world doesn't. And I covered a number of the stories that aren't even on CNN, aren't even on television today. So how's the average person going to know about things like, you know, they're going to formalize and put together all the terrorist groups in Syria now and make them one terrorist group because all terrorists get along so well that they can just appoint the leader and the second leader and whatever. And, you know, they're going to put seven terrorist groups together to make 45,000 people do terrorism together. Now, you know, and we know these stories and we know what's going on. But the average person doesn't. And there's so much that they do not know that it's going to get slammed against them one of these days. And they're going to sit there with their mouth open, drooling, wondering what happened to them. You know, but everybody's busy, you know, watching the end of whatever shows are on the season's end on television and getting ready for Christmas, of course, and celebrating and partying and partying and partying. But there's so much undercurrent that I wish you would address some of that undercurrent that we need to be aware of going into 2014, because I am concerned about it and I do see a crescendo about to take place.
Well, I appreciate the opportunity to talk about this because I think it is important, and I think you're exactly right. It occurs to me, I've been thinking about this quite a bit recently because we are coming towards the end of the year, and obviously people are looking ahead to the new year, and they're going to be hearing all sorts of projections of what's going to be important for the new year. But it strikes me that the things that are important and that really help to shape world events tend to be the things that catch a lot of people completely blindsided. Obviously, the biggest shakeups happen from things we're not expecting rather than things that we are. So I think we have to think a little bit outside of the mainstream box when we're thinking about what to expect in the coming year. That's true even if you're still thinking in something of a mainstream perspective. And obviously, for your listeners who are, I think, better informed on these issues, I think we understand that obviously anything that is getting constant attention in the mainstream press is not probably going to be the determining factor of world events. Things are always happening behind the scenes, and they tend to bubble up to the surface when we least expect them, so that if all you were relying on were the talking heads and the mainstream financial media, you would never have seen the Lehman Brothers collapse coming, for example. And so the question is, well, what is the next big event that's going to be coming down the line? And obviously, I should preface everything I'm going to say tonight by saying, I don't know. I don't have a crystal ball, and I'm not predicting anything per se, but I do see a lot of trends and forces developing for the coming year that do present some, I think, worrying trends that we have to keep our eye on, rather than some of the distraction issues that people are focusing on right now. And when it comes to distraction issues, I mean, there are no shortage of them, and I'm sure we can all point to the recent headlines to take a look at some of them. Obviously, there's still questions about budget negotiations happening in the Congress, looking at the left-right divide and sort of that tempest in a teacup, talking about basically shaving off a little bit of the growth in the U.S. budget over the coming years. I mean, not even beginning to talk about actually cutting back on any of that that incredible debt that's continuing to mount up. But I think more importantly, talking about some of the financial issues that are coming up, obviously everyone this week has their eyes on the Federal Open Market Committee that is going to be taking place in the next couple of days, and they're going to have the post committee meeting transcript, the summary statement, and the press conference by Chairman Bernanke on Wednesday afternoon. And the markets are all primed for this, and we're in a bit of a holding pattern for the next couple of days as people kind of wait for some direction on where they're going to go with this. And everyone, again, once again, is holding their breath. Will the Federal Reserve taper their $85 billion liquidity injection, their quantitative easing QE round 3 that they're currently doing each and every month? will they taper this? Will they cut it back by, you know, 5 billion, 9 billion, 10 billion? Will they cut it back in January, February, March? Will they start this month? The markets await with bated breath the words of Chairman Ben Bernanke and his sage advice for the American economy. But again, I think if everyone is concentrating on this issue, it probably isn't going to be the as important as they're saying it is. And one thing to keep in mind about this whole taper issue is just the fact that even if they do taper, that is, if they cut back on the amount of money that they're pumping into the money supply each and every month, that isn't actually a tightening of the currency. That is only a reduction in the amount that they're growing the currency each month, which, again, isn't as quite as important as they want you to believe, and as the markets are all primed to react, you know, whichever way it goes. So again, we have to keep this in perspective. And when I'm looking at things that are developing on the horizon, obviously I'm shaped by the fact that I live in Japan, so I'm over here in the Asia-Pacific region, so maybe I'm biased on that, but I do see some very interesting stories developing over here that I think will be more and more important as the U.S. in general starts to turn some of its military and other attention towards the Asia-Pacific region. And I think it's going to be a region where we're going to see more and more developing.
Before you go into Asia-Pacific region, I really want to hear that. But your gut feeling right now, are they going to taper? Are they not going to taper? Is the stock market going to start going down as a result of this? Gold start going up finally after all this time? What are your thoughts on that?
Well, to be honest, whether they taper or not and how much they taper and when they start tapering, to be honest, I'm not particularly even concerned about it. If they do start tapering this month, I don't think I would be particularly surprised, but I don't think it's going to be a large amount. And even so, even if and when they do start quote-unquote tapering, I think they're going to find other ways of accomplishing basically the same thing. For example, earlier between QE2 and QE3, there was the Operation Twist program, whereby they were financing long-term treasuries with the sale of short-term treasuries. That type of operation, which isn't strictly speaking a liquidity injection like the quantitative easing programs, but it's basically accomplishing similar ends and keeping those interest rates down, which is really amounts to the same thing in the end. So there are all sorts of little tricks and things that they can play, and they can say, hey, look at the taper. Meanwhile, back in the back rooms, they're still manipulating things from behind the scenes. So I think we shouldn't be focused on that so much. But if I were a betting man, and I'm not, but if I were, I would say that I don't expect them to taper this month. I would assume it would be coming in future months, if it does come at all.
Interesting. And do you think that the stock market will have a rebound effect, given the fact that they might begin tapering in another month or so?
Well, this is an interesting point, because I've seen from a few different analysts now all converging on a rather incredible stock chart that is developing right now. Basically, people have overlaid the 1928-29 run-up to the great stock market crash over top the recent run-up in the Dow Jones over the past, I believe, 18 months or so. And the comparison of the charts is actually striking. I mean, it is a bit breathtaking to look at the incredible parallel in the peaks and troughs, to the point where you can almost overlay the charts on top of each other and they almost look identical, which in and of itself perhaps isn't definitive. It doesn't say with any certainty what's coming, but just that similarity is very interesting, especially because, of course, we know that the ballooning of the bubble in the 20s was almost inevitably preceded by the contraction of the money supply and the collapse of the Great Depression. And if these charts continue to overlay the way they are, basically we're looking at the beginning of the crash, the equivalent of the 1929 crash, in January of next year, i.e. next month, would be the beginnings of this, if those charts continue to overlay. And I've seen a few different analysts pointing this out now. I think that's particularly interesting. So I don't know what's coming in terms of what Bernanke is going to say, but the markets certainly are primed to take off if there is no tapering, and they are primed to fall if there is tapering, because again, the entire economy at this point is really being supported by the smoke and mirrors of this Federal Reserve funny money creation that they're doing on a monthly basis. And when that punch bowl is taken away, the markets are going to have quite a hangover. And that might be, I mean, I don't know, but that might be the type of thing that might start that that 1929 style collapse. And again, I'm not trying to panic anyone or to ring a false alarm bell here, but I am saying that there are analysts that are talking about that stunning similarity in the charts, and who knows what the catalyst on that would be precisely. But certainly something like a taper might be the beginning of the end for this incredible run-up that we've seen in the stock markets that's based on really no run-up in actual underlying economic productivity.
Well, what's going to happen then? I know our guest in the next hour is going to talk about perhaps the ability for the Bitcoin to sort of move in and replace the gold as a gold standard. Now, that's a subject we're going to have in this next hour, and he's going to present a case why that might happen. But is there a chance in your mind that that could actually take place, that they would not reinstate gold as the to back the dollar, but go ahead and use the Bitcoin for that? Have you thought about that?
Well, not only myself, but it has been suggested, if even only jokingly, by no less an organization than the Council on Foreign Relations. They were having a panel discussion recently about the dollar, and someone suggested, perhaps half jokingly, it did elicit some guffaws, but suggested the Bitcoin as a new international standard currency. I mean, at least the idea is starting to work its way into discourse, and even if it is a bit poo-pooed at the moment, I mean, it is one that some organizations are beginning to take seriously. And if not Bitcoin itself, at least that idea of some sort of centrally coordinated currency, virtual currency or of some sort. Maybe it would be different in details than the Bitcoin, but one could imagine how the system is kind of being moved towards that. And I've often talked in the past about the moves towards a cashless society, which is, I think, part of the moves towards global government.
So. Absolutely. 4 minute break. We'll be back with James Corbett. Welcome back to Power Hour. Thank you for joining us. Caring about your world, doing the next right and honorable thing 24 minutes after the hour, wherever you are sitting. Remember, you can listen to the Power Hour on International Shortwave 13.845 and 7.490 from 7 to 10 a.m. Central Time, or the replay at 4.840 from 2 to 5 a.m. Central Time. And we have one of the best new shortwave radios at the Power Hour that is powered 6 different ways. That's right, 6 different ways. You ought to find some way to get the power going on that radio. It is awesome. Give us a call at 877-817-9829, 877-817-9829, or go to thepowermall.com. We're talking to James Corbett today. He is an independent thinker. He is an investigative writer, and he has one of the best contributions both to the Corbett Report and to International Forecaster, thecorbettreport.com, C-O-R-B-E-T-T. Go to the guest section, and you'll find the information. Just click on the Corbett Report. We're in talking about the changes that may come about in 2014, or what we need to be aware of. There's a lot of things that are just quietly right now under the surface. And you were talking in terms of the budget issue, number one, whether or not they're going to lay off of the giving away of free money to anybody and everybody that they seem to want to give it to. What else do you see as the issues that we need to be concerned about going into 2014, James?
Right. Well, to be clear, I think those are the issues that a lot of the media are concentrating on right now. So I think the real action is probably going to be taking place elsewhere. And as I say, again, I'm here in Japan, so I see things through that filter. But I really do think that this is going to be an increasingly important region in the coming years, and especially starting off in the new year. And I say that specifically because I'm sure pretty much everyone in the audience has probably seen in recent months the growing tensions that are happening in the region militarily. And people who haven't been following this closely might not know, but recently China started a new Air Defense Identification Zone, an ADIZ, that encompasses a region around their airspace, around their actual national airspace, and out towards some areas that are claimed by, for example, by Japan. And even over those disputed islands that in the East China Sea that have been the source of tension between Japan and China recently. What does this ultimately actually mean? It means that China is now expecting any flights that go through this ADIZ space to inform China before they go through of their flight plan and identify themselves as they fly through, which perhaps doesn't seem like such a big deal, but it is a change in the status quo at any rate, and it's being played off as some sort of great affront to American and Japanese and Korean and other interests in the region, as if China is suddenly like a madman trying to escalate things in the region. I think there's a perhaps a different way of looking at it, when one way is to say, well, for example, Japan has had its own air defense identification zones for the last, I believe, 42 years or something of that sort. But at any rate, so this is being seen as some sort of ratcheting up of the tensions. And in fact, the latest incident is being reported by the Global Times, which is a Chinese newspaper. It's basically an adjunct of the Chinese government. It's an official newspaper. And they are now reporting that on December 5th, there was an incident in the South China Sea where a USS the USS Cowpens was on military maneuvers out there with the US Pacific Fleet and was harassing, apparently, the Chinese aircraft carrier. China has recently commissioned an aircraft carrier, the Liaoning, and it was out there doing some drills with some of its support ships and apparently was being harassed by this U.S. ship, the USS Cowpens, which eventually had to do some sort of evasive measures to avoid a collision with a Chinese ship. And they're saying this is basically one of the most serious sea confrontations that's taken place between the U.S. and China in years, and is yet another ratcheting up of the tensions in this region. So we're seeing an awful lot of this right now, and the question is, where is this heading? And I think it would be easy to say, well, obviously, this is heading towards some sort of military confrontation. But I really don't think that's what it is. I think if we really look at what's happening here, I really do believe we are seeing the beginning of this setup for the Cold War of the 21st century. And for people who know their history and know about the Cold War of the 20th century between the Soviets and the US, they know that a lot of that was smoke and mirrors that was being funded and maintained and fostered by the US defense contractors, who obviously stood to gain billions upon billions upon billions of dollars from the hyping up of that threat. And we know specifically now from documents that have been released and the histories that have been written that groups such as the RAND Corporation were overhyping the USSR's missile capabilities in order to make the U.S. Increase their stockpile and start the arms race.
Oh, my heart be still. That's exactly what I said last week. I cannot believe you're saying that. That is absolutely. We're going to come back and talk about the China-Japan Senkaku Island mess after this 3-minute break with a Power Hour. James Corbett, this is Joel. We're talking with our guest today, James Corbett, and the issue of China and Japan has really interested me, because at first I was wondering, is this good cop, bad cop? Then the United States entered in, you know, Biden goes over there, kind of makes a fool of himself, and goes on to China. Japan says, well, I don't know if he's really on our side or not. And this whole thing seems to be evolving over some islands that, since you're in that area, what do you know about those Senkaku Islands? Is there anything that people need to be fighting over?
Well, all I know about them is that we didn't hear a peep about them until very recently. And that, I think that's interesting in and of itself. And all of the kind of nationalistic bluster that's surrounding this, both on the Chinese and Japanese side, and Taiwan as well has its finger in that pie, I think is absolutely just bald-faced lie to a certain extent. I mean, I think people are being whipped into a nationalist fervor over something that doesn't benefit them in any tangible sense. For people who don't know, this island chain, the Senkaku Islands, as they're called in Japanese, are basically out there in the East China Sea between Japan and China, but they're completely uninhabited. No one lives there. And it's not a great source of anything at the moment. The only thing is that in, I believe it was the late 1960s, a geological survey showed that there is the potential for oil and gas in the bedrock around those islands. And suddenly, after hearing about that, China decided that they wanted to restake their claim, their traditional historical claim to the islands. And just in recent years, this has become a real point of tension as China starts building up its navy. And as I say, even commissioning an aircraft carrier recently. So China definitely trying to throw its muscle around. And now suddenly we see all of this nationalistic fervor about these uninhabited islands that no one has ever visited, let alone knows anything about. So I think it is definitely just a chess piece on this board that's convenient as a way to get people whipped up over nationalist sentiment. And certainly, I mean, there's no love lost between Japan and China and the populations of those countries. And I think they'll rally around basically any sort of issue as an excuse to bring up those old nationalist fervors.
Well, you know, I think, as if I have any idea what's going on here, but I do think that if there is resources there, gold or silver or oil or whatever, gas or whatever, I'm surprised we haven't bombed them by now. That would be my only response. It's sure, I mean, anywhere there's a potential for resources, the U.S. is bombing them. So I would give it just a little time. But still, the Japanese and Chinese adversarial situation, could it be pushed into a World War III like some people are talking about? Or do you, like you say, do you think it's just a blustering of powers?
Well, let's put it this way. Could it happen? It certainly could. Am I expecting it to? I am not. The way I'm reading the tensions right now, obviously we have to understand that Japan, when we're talking about Japan in its rivalry with China, we are essentially talking about the United States. I mean, Japan really falls under the U.S. military umbrella, is completely backed up by that U.S. military might, and is kind of U.S.'s strongest toehold in the region. So we have to understand it from that perspective. This is really kind of a U.S.-China confrontation that's taking place right now, more so than it is a Japanese-Chinese one. And this is part of what we've heard is the turn to the Asia-Pacific that was announced a couple of years ago by the Pentagon and is part of that big buildup. But the way that I'm reading this is not as some sort of military confrontation that's going to happen. I really do think that this is, if anything, at base, I think this is a form of economic stimulus. I think we have to understand it from that perspective. This is kind of that Keynesian idea. World War II solved the Great Depression. You know, if we can just create that kind of big threat that everyone can rally around, it'll be like the Cold War, as I was saying earlier, in the post-war period for the few decades after the World War II. We saw some of the largest growth in global wealth in human history, and that was largely on the back of this Cold War that was taking place that justified the incredible amounts of expenditures on both sides, but of course, very much prominently so on the U.S. side towards the defense sector. And I really think they're looking for that type of boogeyman for the 21st century, and I think China is going to fit that bill, because as I'm sure a lot of your listeners know, China has been consciously built up by the real ruling oligarchy of the United States and the Western countries generally over the past few decades, with the conscious offshoring of so much of America's manufacturing capacity to China. I think that a lot of this is smoke and mirrors, and I don't think there is going to be that military confrontation. I really see this in an economic sense as convenient to both sides as an excuse to increase basically their military budgets and thus increase spending generally. Having said that, just like in the Cold War scenario in the 20th century, we now know that the Joint Chiefs of Staff, for example, were constantly lobbying Kennedy and presumably every other president to try to start World War III at any possible moment that they could get their hands on it. And they were trying to bomb the USSR at every possible opportunity. Who knows what crazies are infesting the upper ranks of the Pentagon and the White House these days, and whether or not someone might get their hands on the levers of power and start something. I mean, all it takes is one crazy move to start something that was unintended. So we do have to keep that possibility in mind, too.
Well, I thought it was kind of funny when Japan says, we're not going to file a flight plan. I thought that was pretty gutsy myself. And then the U.S. said, Japan told the United States not to file any flight plans. The United States says, I think we will. I think we'll file a flight plan. You know, so, you know, it does have, seems like sort of the recipe for problems, though, because one plane going down from Japan is kind of going to create a little bit of a, you know, is going to up the tension, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely so. And one can only imagine what would result from that. Even just the, not necessarily the shooting down of a plane, but just the taking down of the escorting down of a plane to over Chinese airspace or something of that sort would be obviously a huge international incident. And there was a similar thing back in the 1980s in the Cold War, the height of the US-USSR Cold War with the KAL 007 that was shot down by Soviet forces. huge incident at the time, obviously, and one that that ultimately resulted in the U.S. military's GPS system being given to commercial aviation and eventually filtering its way down to the general public. Kind of a bizarre footnote in history, but so we do have parallels for that type of situation, but certainly it is the type of wild card event that, who knows? I mean, in the event of something like that, all bets are off the table over how those people would be reacting in that situation.
Absolutely. What else do you see as a real problem that we need to be aware of? Perhaps maybe we're not hearing enough about right now. Anything else in the horizon?
Absolutely. Well, we were talking earlier about the idea of Bitcoin replacing gold as some sort of international standard. I'm skeptical about that. I'll be interested to hear your guest's take on that. But in the meantime, we certainly have been talking a lot in recent years about the possibility of China, if not eclipsing the dollar, at least catching up to the dollar. And in fact, we saw that happen earlier this, I believe last month, when the Chinese yuan currency became the second most used currency in the world. Just to put things in perspective, the dollar is still predominantly number one, and more than 80% of international trade is settled in U.S. dollars. So clearly, the U.S. dollar is not in immediate threat of being overtaken by any currency. But the Chinese yuan is now accounting for 8.6% of global trade. And to put that in perspective, just less than 2 years ago, in January of 2012, the Chinese currency only accounted for 1.9% of global trade. So we've seen a 500% increase in the use of the Chinese currency in less than 2 years. That's a pretty remarkable growth rate right there, and it speaks volumes to what's happening internationally right now. And as Simon Black of SovereignMan.com pointed out recently, a really significant story took place recently that very few people have heard about. There's recently the Singapore Exchange and the Hong Kong Exchange signed a memorandum of understanding. And for people who don't know, these are two major exchanges, obviously both in China, very important in the Asian region. And basically, like the London and New York stock exchanges, I mean, it would be as if they were, if not merging, at least forming some sort of compact. And in this case, with Singapore and Hong Kong signing this memorandum of understanding, the idea is they're going to start releasing more financial products denominated in the Chinese currency. They're both working together now against, really, presumably against the dollar and the dollar's stranglehold over international finance. So again, another indication of where things are heading. And I think there's an awfully long way to go before the dollar is eclipsed, as I say. But I think the writing is really on the wall, unless something drastically were to change between now and the foreseeable future.
Looking at the stock market today, it's already been up over 183 points or 170 some points. I mean, happy days are here again. The Nikkei was down like 200 and some. You know, the Asian stocks are down, European up. U.S. is like happy days are here again. What's the reason? Have they given any reason for the stock market being so good today?
I don't know about specifically today. My sense is that the stock markets are in a bit of a holding pattern at the moment, waiting for that Wednesday FOMC meeting and to see what eventuates from that. And certainly gold, I think, is stuck in that pattern right now, waiting for that. And presumably, if the taper were to happen, we would see a decline in gold, because the idea would be that they're tightening up the dollar. Again, I think that's a lot of smoke and mirrors, and I'm not following the day-to-day maneuvers in the Dow Jones and other such markets right now, because they are so not reflective of I think the underlying economic situation. But on that note, again, of kind of wild cards that could really affect the American economy in the coming year. Of course, there's Obamacare and the rollout of that and the ongoing fiasco. But here's something that's even further off people's radar, but probably will actually even more strongly affect the American economy in the long run. That's a pair of trade agreements that are being worked out right now. One of them, which people I hope have at least heard about right now, is the Trans-Pacific Partnership that, again, is being worked out in the Asia-Pacific region between the U.S. and 12 of its partners around this region, including some of the big economies, Japan, and some of the smaller economies, Malaysia and Singapore and the like. But also, simultaneously, there's now a new trade pact that's being worked on behind the scenes, the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is being worked out between the U.S. and the EU. And again, this is happening right now as well. And together, these two pacts will account for 60% of the world's GDP will fall under these free trade agreements. And people are calling it NAFTA on steroids. And I think deservedly so. The ramifications of this for the U.S. economy and for U.S. sovereignty itself are pretty overwhelming.
What scares me about it is this stealth, you know, mechanism of operation of bringing it into being is that it's all so secret. And we'll probably never know what it really involves until the day we get it. And then we won't even know. But what, why the secrecy behind the Trans-Pacific Partnership?
The long story short is that they've, I think, learned their lessons from previous rounds of political wrangling that's gone on, not only in the U.S., looking specifically at some of those internet acts that were floating around the Senate and the Congress the last couple of years, the SOPA Act and the PIPA Act, that were going to affect the way that people are basically policed online for copyright infringement and the like, but also international treaties like the ACTA treaty that was being worked on that was essentially the same type of thing. Again, a global enforcement policy for intellectual property rights online, etc., that was being worked out in treaties. And these were relatively open. People could read them online. People could understand what was in them. People could follow the negotiations. And as a result, we saw huge amounts of people coming out, I believe it was March 2012, coming out against these bills in the Senate and the Congress and in the treaty itself. And we saw all three of them taken down quite handily once the people were informed about this and started acting on it. I think they learned their lessons from that and have decided, well, this negotiation for this Trans-Pacific Partnership and this Transatlantic Partnership, we're just going to go behind closed doors. We're not going to tell people what's going on, and we're going to keep it completely out of the media spotlight, and people basically won't know what hit them till it hits them. And unfortunately, they've been remarkably successful at this so far, with very little leaking out. However, just last month, WikiLeaks actually did manage to release one of the chapters of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement that they're currently working on, and which might even be done in time for Christmas, although that's perhaps unlikely at this point, but certainly it is coming in the near future. And this chapter that they released is about the intellectual property rights that they're working on, and it contains all of the scary things in SOPA and PIPA and ACTA that people were so concerned about and spilling out onto the streets about a couple of years ago. They're basically all there, and in fact, some of them are even worse in the language they have in this draft text. But again, people just aren't really informed about what's happening. And the long story short is that basically, ISPs, internet service providers, are going to become kind of the global police in this system to look for infringement of, you know, people downloading copyrighted materials or sharing copyrighted materials. And basically, the ISPs are going to become the big brother looking over everyone's shoulder and deciding what can and can't appear online and how people are policed on in that regard. And the image of the internet that might result if this is taken to the extremes that we imagine it probably will be taken to is not a happy place. I mean, we've already seen a lot of internet activity being controlled by these very few corporations, these Twitters and Facebooks and YouTubes, where everyone starts to congregate more and more, and which can, with a stroke of their keyboard, take whatever you post offline. They can censor it. They can do whatever. They can remove your account. That's the image of the internet that we're looking at as these start to go into place. And the worst part about this is that it's a treaty that's being worked out in the international level. It's not a law that's being passed by Congress. So if you're a U.S. citizen and you're concerned about this and you don't like the way it goes, you can't just go to Congress and say, you know, we have to change this. The way to change this treaty will be to go to the WTO and to petition and have an international arbitration of this. And it's going to be basically hardwired into international law. So this is very scary for a number of reasons. But really, at the end of the day, I mean, just the sovereignty issue itself is absolutely central to this.
Wow. If I were to explain to somebody standing at Walmart what the TPP is, can you give us just kind of like a paragraph of what we do know about the TPP, what it is and who it's with?
We do know that it's a free trade agreement that's being worked out right now. It covers basically every conceivable, imaginable aspect of trade and commerce, but that's such a broad definition that it covers, I mean, so much that people wouldn't even expect. I'm talking about things like for example, access to medicine in developing countries.
We got to go to this break. We'll be back 3 minutes after this break with James Corbett. Stay tuned. This is Joyce Riley with James Corbett. We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
It's been said, those who control the food control the people. Are you concerned about GMO foods making you sick and affecting your mind? Many people suffer from lack of energy, insomnia, loss of stamina, weight gain, and the inability to think clearly. Genetically modified crops, processed foods, and toxic chemicals can compromise your health and are silently destroying your digestive system, which accounts for 80% of your immune system. Take back control of your health with Pro-EM1 Probiotic from Terraganics. Pro-EM1 Probiotic helps protect your body against irritable bowel syndrome, constipation, Crohn's disease, celiac disease, diabetes, the common cold, and much more. And including a powerful probiotic like Pro-EM1 as part of your daily routine puts you back in control and prevents you from becoming a mindless zombie manipulated by the pharmaceutical and GMO agendas. Call Terraganics at 866-369-3678 or visit Terraganics.com. TerraGanix.com.
Time and time again.
You need to come here and help us. We need assistance. Please.
Those we should be able to depend on let us down.
Federal and state and local officials saying help is on the way. Well, the folks here in Bell Harbor say show me.
Don't depend on the government to save you. Take action now so that you're prepared for the next disaster with MyPatriotSupply.com. Get the best prices on storable food, non-GMO seeds, water filtration devices, home canning equipment, survival and self-reliance books, and more at MyPatriotSupply.com. Call 866-229-0927.
We are hurting down here, and we need help immediately.
Before it's time to survive, it's time to prepare. MyPatriotSupply.com. MyPatriotSupply.com.
Welcome back to Power Hour. Thank you for joining us. Caring about your world and doing the next right and honorable thing, and that means standing on what you believe in. We're talking to James Corbett today about what the future holds or what he sees that we need to be concerned about. This whole TPP, TPA, it's hard to explain what it is because there's so little known about it. How do we know that it's such a bad thing? I know they call it NAFTA on steroids, but how do we know it's such a bad thing if we don't even know what is in it?
Well, again, we do have leaked drafts of certain parts of the treaty, including, as I say, the intellectual property part of the treaty. We also know, for example, some of the mechanism that's in there for dispute settlement. So if, for example, a foreign investor is making an investment in the territory of a nation and that nation changes its laws to affect the business practices of that foreign investor, the foreign investor can actually take that country to international settlement through the United Nations Commission on International Trade Law. And there's we actually have the draft text of how that will be handled, that a tribunal will be appointed. It will consist of three arbitrators, one chosen by the investor, one by the state in question, and one by a mutually agreed party, and basically how they would go through that. But the idea is that ultimately foreign corporations will be able to sue, for example, the United States, if they pass a law that actually affects those business interests. And again, this is exactly what we've seen time and time again with the concerns that people have had over various free trade deals and the formation of the WTO itself. So perhaps this doesn't strike anyone as particularly new, but it's a further hardwiring into law of these types of, again, complete erosions of national sovereignty to the point where it won't even really matter which political puppets that we put into power are anymore. As we know, they are generally chosen in advance and don't really have a lot of effect on anything anyway. But even given that, there will be even less of a chance for people to actually affect anything through the political process once this is in place. Because again, it will all be done through international tribunals that will take place in courts in far distant lands that have no bearing whatsoever to what you or the average American citizen want to have happen. So we do know some of the things that are in this. Again, it's over 1,000 pages at this point, and we only have a couple of leaked sections, so we don't have a lot to go on, but what we do have is already pretty worrying.
Why is it the United States would go along with this? What is in it for our best interest to go along with this trade deal?
It's an excellent question, and I think it gets to the heart of the matter, because the answer, the way I see it, is that ultimately, this isn't something that's seen in national terms by the people who are arguing and negotiating over this, because at the end of the day, the people who are really in charge of this process and the system in general, I think, are people who do not conform to national identity. These are not Americans who are arguing or negotiating with other people in Japan or Brunei or Malaysia. These are basically the corporatocrats, the pathocrats, the people who really don't care, don't have anything in common with the average American citizen, but they might have everything in common with the oligarchical interests in, for example, a big Japanese corporation like Mitsubishi or Sony. This is, I think, the way that we have to understand this. And we, at our level of understanding, the people we correspond with and the people we talk to do identify themselves as, oh, well, I'm American, the people around me are American, or what have you. And that's the way we see ourselves. But we have to understand that this upper level, I really don't think they care at all about the American people. They could care less about what happens to them. They want what's in their own interests. And I think that's the way we have to understand these agreements, because ultimately the end game of all of this, I think, is the erosion of the United States and what it is and what it represents, and the idea that it is a separate entity from the rest of the world. What we're looking at is the process of globalization, whereby it won't matter what country you live in, you're all going to be living under the same rules, and they're all going to be stacked against you and in favor of these corporate elite and the other interests that are very much at the top of this pyramid.
Well, today, Mr. Podesta, the new assistant, one of the assistants to Obama, announces that we're going to give up the oceans to the United Nations, or that would be a good idea. I mean, whatever happened to up by and for the little people, ladies and gentlemen, doesn't exist any longer. They're giving everything away. Everything. We'll be back. 1 minute, 10 seconds. Final segment with James Corbett. Welcome back to Power Hour. Thank you for joining us, caring about your world. In the next hour, we're going to be talking, continuing the discussion of financial issues with Jason Erb. What is the Bitcoin? Why are we going to think about using it? Why would they want to use it? Why would we want to give away our oceans, according to John Podesta? I mean, he thinks that's a great idea. And I have to ask our guest today, after all these things we've been talking about, the TPP, TPA, giving away our oceans, to our guest, James Corbett. James, I hate to ask this redundant question that I always ask, but what is the end game to giving away everything the United States has?
The ultimate end game is the creation of global government. That's where it's heading. That's where it's been heading for generations, really. And there's been a concerted effort to move us along that path. And that has long been decried, of course, as crazy conspiracy theory, but it gets less crazy each and every single day. And as the headlines get crazier and crazier, maybe we have to adjust our sense of what is crazy and what is actually happening. And I can't stress it enough, the creation of a global enslavement grid is the end game for the people who control the system at the way it is right now. And that's why I think we have to be putting ourselves against these types of ridiculous trade deals and everything else that they're trying to subject us to, while we still have the ability to insert ourselves into this mix. And I know it's not a big window of opportunity, but at the very least it exists. And if we're not putting all of our efforts into trying to derail these plans at this moment, I don't know what we're doing, because this is the time to be acting.
I don't know how we can derail something we don't really know anything about, the TPP and the TPA. Just like I went to Washington 3 times, and with 35,000 nurses, 35,000, We shut down, and I know my listeners are tired of hearing this, but we shut down from the Capitol to the White House. 35,000 nurses in white uniforms. You would think there might even be a photo op there. You would, and yet nothing. 35 flaming thousand nurses against NAFTA and against the oncoming onslaught of bad health care. There was every kind of television network that you can imagine that was there. There were pictures being taken everywhere. There were all those big satellite dish trucks there, everything, and not one picture in the newspaper.
I can't say I'm surprised, but it just goes to prove the point. The revolution will not be televised, and that's why people are tuning out of the dinosaur media in droves and turning towards the alternative media and listening to more programs like this one each and every single day. And that's really the space in which we have, I think, the power and the opportunity to act. Again, they're not going to televise and talk about our successes. We're going to have to do that for ourselves, which is why it's important for us to connect and to be informed through alternative media and also to be active in those ways. And another excellent way that we can actually derail these plans that are taking place behind closed doors that we have no access to is the concept of nullification. I just talked about this on my podcast, talking about the idea of nullifying the NSA. And basically, the idea is the NSA requires water and electricity for its data center. Work on the businesses and the governments that are cooperating with the NSA to withdraw their cooperation, to literally turn the taps off on the NSA and to stop it from functioning. And this is the type of thing that people actually can have an effect on at this moment, at this point in time. It's a really interesting idea. I hope people will check it out. Again, that's on my most recent podcast episode, so people can go and find out more about how they can actually affect something during this time of just complete crackdown.
Well, I appreciate that. We'll put that in our email blast and send that out to all of our people also, because this kind of information, how we can be active in a system that chooses to be so quiet and so silent and so covert, is getting to be more and more of a problem. And then it comes out like the Obamacare program, or you know, Nancy Pelosi said, you know, we got to pass it to find out what's in it. You know, doesn't, you know, I mean, you would think there'd be Wharton School of Business graduates that would say, that doesn't sound right. But you know, where are the people that make the sense, like James Corbett? James, thank you so much for joining us today on the Power Hour. We salute you. Thank you for being a part of us.
Well, thank you for the opportunity. I always enjoy it. And if I don't talk to you before then, I hope everyone has a happy new year and a safe new year.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much. You have a blessed season also. We'll be back, ladies and gentlemen, 3-minute break with Jason Erb. Stay tuned. This is the Power Hour.